Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Rising prices. Inflation increases above expectations yet again, driven by higher costs for energy, food, and housing. Then, Biden abroad. The president visits Israel, the first stop of a Middle East trip that is raising questions about diplomatic relations and human rights in the region. And abortion battles. As more states ban abortion in the U.S., Poland enforces its own new restrictions, threatening jail time for anyone who helps a woman terminate a pregnancy.
I knew exactly how hard it was for her to fight for her dignity, to fight for her right to stop this pregnancy. And this was my only motivation to really share my own peace with her.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Inflation in the U.S. is the highest it's been in four decades, and new numbers out today give no reassurance it will let up soon. The Labor Department reported that consumer prices jumped 9.1% over last year, worse than economists had projected. Gas prices were up more than 11% in June. Furniture, clothing, health care, groceries, and cars grew more expensive as well. Beyond increases in food and energy prices, the core inflation index rose 0.7% over the previous month. To break down what this means for the economy and the American people, I'm joined by Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal. Greg Ipp, welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thanks for having me.
So, not such good news, and it looks like this is across the board, that almost everything's getting more expensive.
I think that was what was disappointing and surprising, is that there really was no good news in this report. I mean, obviously the big increase came from energy and food. Gasoline, as everybody knows, has gotten a lot more expensive in recent months. That's what pushed us over the 9% level, the highest annual rate of inflation in over 40 years. Food was very expensive, like dairy products up like at least 1%. Most food categories up over 10% in the last year. But when you dig below those sort of more volatile categories, it's troubling that even things that normally don't move around very much are also steadily moving up, like housing. The cost of shelter is up 6%. That's not just like renting an apartment, but it's also the way the government measures the price of owning your own home. And the troubling thing about that is twofold. First of all, it's a very big chunk of the basket of goods and services that people buy, so it has a big effect on inflation. And the second is it's very slow moving and very kind of like a super tanker. Once that number starts going, it tends to like stick around for a long time. So that means it could be a while before inflation comes back down.
Is it clear, Greg, what is driving these prices up, what the factors are behind this?
So I think by this point we can say there's a few things. First of all, clearly the war in Ukraine has contributed both to higher energy prices and to higher food prices, but that's only a little bit of the story. The other part of the story is that the economy has recovered very, very rapidly from the COVID shutdown. Part of that was fueled by low interest rates and government stimulus, and the economy has never fully managed to get the supply side working again. There are people missing from the labor force. There are supply chains that have not basically reasserted themselves. We're still selling fewer cars than we did 2 years ago because we still can't get enough parts.
So there are some experts out there, and you've seen them, who are saying, well, we're getting close to a peak, that inflation is going to start to come down. Do you see a sign of that?
Well, I was one of those people who said a few months ago that I thought we were close to a peak, and so I'm eating a little humble crow this afternoon. We're not at a peak yet. And again, the troubling thing is that some of those volatile categories that we thought were temporary are in fact coming down, but other factors like housing are there for a while. Look, the thing that will ultimately bring this down, I think, is two things. First of all, with a bit of time, some of those supply side problems, like with the cars, will correct themselves. But the bigger issue is that the Federal Reserve has to cool the economy down by raising interest rates. That's not a pleasant process. It usually means higher unemployment and slower growth and possibly a recession.
And I want to ask you about that because right now all eyes are on the Federal Reserve. Speculation they're going to need to raise interest rates, or they will raise interest rates even more than they had suggested they would. There is really no formula that's tried and true for the Fed, is there?
Well, there is. For example, Paul Volcker, when he came into office 40 years ago, his formula was raise those interest rates until the economy keels over and inflation falls. If it has a little bit of that feel, if not quite as bad as that. Look, Even after several increases, the federal funds interest rates are still extremely low. There's talk that they'll raise it at least a 0.75 percentage point in a couple weeks. Some people think they'll raise it a full percentage point. But even if they do, the rate will still be below 3%, which is below the rate of inflation.
Right.
Everything we know tells us that rate has got to get above the rate of inflation to start slowing the economy down and acting on inflation.
Is it clear which is worse? Rising inflation or a recession? I mean, is it clear that a recession is to be avoided at all costs, or that higher inflation is to be avoided at all costs?
Neither is very pleasant. American people have been through a lot of both in the last few years, and they don't really want either. But look, from the Federal Reserve's point of view, the choice isn't inflation or a recession. It's deal with inflation now, even if it involves a recession, or deal with it later when inflation is higher and more entrenched and the recession will be even deeper. And let's not forget, recessions are hard on the people who lose their jobs, but inflation is hard on everybody, those who lose their jobs and those who keep their jobs, especially those on lower incomes, which spend especially large shares of their budget on things like food and gasoline.
So it sounds like you're saying whatever the Fed can do to get some kind of hold on inflation is going to be the priority.
I think what we could say in the past is that when inflation was always around 2% and sometimes it was too low, the Fed had the luxury of doing everything it could to prevent recession and keep unemployment low. It doesn't have that luxury today. They don't want a recession, but if the only way to get inflation back down is to raise interest rates, slow demand, and as a result have a recession, that seems to be a price that they are willing to pay. They're not happy about it, but they don't see a lot of alternatives.
Sobering, but we need to hear it. Greg Epp, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
In the day's other news, President Biden is in Israel tonight, kicking off his first Middle East tour as president. As he arrived, he declared the U.S. and Israel have, quote, a bone-deep bond. He was briefed on missile defenses, and he laid a wreath at the nation's Holocaust memorial. He heads to Saudi Arabia later this week. We'll take a closer look after the news summary. Ukraine and Russia today held their first direct talks in months, this time on resuming grain shipments through the Black Sea. A Russian blockade has raised the risk of starvation in countries that are dependent on the grain. Officials from the two sides met in Istanbul, Turkey, today with UN representatives. Later, the UN Secretary General called it an important step.
We are hoping that we'll be able to reconvene very soon, I'm sure next week, and hopefully we'll be able to have a final agreement. But, as I said, we still need a lot of goodwill and commitment by all parties.
Meanwhile, Russian forces entered the Ukrainian city of Siversk in their campaign to capture much of eastern Ukraine. Political turmoil in Sri Lanka grew even worse today. The president of the island nation in the Indian Ocean fled the country and tried to make his prime minister the acting president. With that, thousands of protesters stormed the prime minister's office. They braved tear gas fired by police, and they demanded change to rebuild a collapsed economy.
This is not a struggle that spreads hate. This is a peaceful struggle. The whole world must see this as a peaceful protest because they are fighting for the future of children. Children have nothing to eat. There's no fuel in the country.
Despite the chaos, the prime minister insisted he will not step down until a new government is named. It's not clear when that will happen. Protests over fuel shortages in Haiti shut down roads in Port-au-Prince today. A war between rival gangs has forced a key fuel terminal to close, and most gas stations have stopped working, too. At least 50 people have died in the violence, and thousands more have no food or water. Back in this country, the FDA gave emergency authorization to the Novavax vaccine for COVID-19. If the CDC also agrees, the two-dose series will be available to anyone over the age of 18. This is the fourth vaccine that the FDA has approved for adults in the U.S. And in this country, Wall Street took an early tumble on the inflation news, but ended with more modest losses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up 208 points to close at 30,772. The Nasdaq fell 17 points. The S&P 500 also slipped 17. Still to come on the News Hour, a new fast-spreading COVID variant prompts higher infection and reinfection rates. Educator Mary McLeod Bethune becomes the first Black American honored in the U.S. Capitol's Statuary Hall. A Ukrainian jazz pianist discusses the impact the Russian invasion has had on his work, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we reported, President Biden arrived in Israel today, the beginning of a four-day Middle East trip that will also take him to Saudi Arabia. Much of today's focus was on Israel's military and regional cooperation against Iran. But as Nick Schifrin reports, President Biden also began his trip with a visit to a solemn site.
It is one of Israel's most sacred spaces, the Holocaust Museum Yad Vashem's Hall of Remembrance. President Biden and Israeli leaders on the mosaic floor etched with the names of Nazi murder sites. President Biden embraced American-Israeli Holocaust survivors, and he paused above the crypt full of ashes of Holocaust victims. Never again, say the U.S. and Israel, as Israel has tried to guarantee itself. Today, it demonstrated for the president its newest military technology.
Target launched.
An air defense system that uses lasers to shoot down missiles. Israel's primary concern is Iran, and in an interview on Israeli TV released tonight, President Biden warned Iran the military option was on the table.
In the past, said you'll do anything, and you say it again, that you'll ensure Iran would not acquire nuclear weapons. Does that also mean, sir, that you would use force against Iran? Is that what that means?
That was the last resort, yes. Mm-hmm.
President Biden still wants an Iranian nuclear deal over Israeli concerns, but today he emphasized his support for Israeli security.
Because the connection between the Israeli people and the American people is bone deep. We have reaffirmed the unshakable commitment of the United States to Israel's security.
One of Israel's most critical points when it comes to security is here, its northern border with Lebanon. Israel's built this wall just in the last few months. On the other side of it, Hezbollah, and it's 130,000 rockets.
In Lebanon, Hezbollah holds extensive political and military power. It's fought two wars with Israel, and Israel says it continues to fire and deploy advanced missiles with Iranian technology on the border, including in Lebanese towns that peer over Israel's wall. Between the countries, a single barrel that marks the blue line, a UN buffer zone. Today, Israeli troops patrol along the border. The barbed wire is Israel. Just a few hundred feet away, a Hezbollah shack. Behind its fluttering front door, members of Hezbollah hid from our camera. The group calls this an office for environmental study.
What in fact you're seeing is a Hezbollah intelligence collection center, and it's there in order to monitor Israeli activity and to collect intelligence on everything on the Israeli border.
Jonathan Conricus is in the Israeli Defense Forces Active Reserves and is the IDF's former international spokesman. Our interview was arranged by the IDF.
We're talking about 95% of the Israeli population is within rocket range of Hezbollah. They now today have 130,000 rockets hidden behind Lebanese civilians, and all of them aimed, or in the future will be aimed, at Israeli civilians.
And now there is a new wave of tension, the maritime border between Israel and Lebanon, near a gas field that Israel considers vital to its future security. Last week, unmanned Hezbollah drones approached the field. The Israeli military shot them down. But here, on the coast closest to the gas field, Israel knows the threat is growing thanks to Iranian technology.
Standard level UAVs provided by Iran. Iran has a vast, deep, and very developed UAV industry. And today there are Iranian UAVs in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, and of course in Iran.
That spreading Iranian threat has helped spark regional coordination that Israel and the U.S. are eager to expand.
During your visit, we will discuss matters of national security. We will discuss building a new security and economy architecture with the nations of the Middle East.
Israel certainly hopes that architecture runs through Jerusalem. They have the military technology here, thanks to U.S. support. But what they're hoping, according to Israeli officials, is that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia creates more political support, Judy, for more regional integration between Israel and their Arab neighbors.
So, Nick, you mentioned regional cooperation. How much of that is actually happening there?
Yeah, the key there is air defense, Judy. And in order to have regional air defense, you have to be able to communicate instantly and digitally. And I talked to a former senior military official who's been in the middle of this effort. And this official said that they were making progress. They held some exercises regionally. They shared some data. And they said that there are countries that are cooperating fully, Jordan, Bahrain, Egypt, and Israel. But so far, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, according to this official, have not been communicating as much as they need to. And Kuwait and Iraq are actually actively resisting. So, Judy, there is a long way to go before you could actually get the kind of integrated defense and procedures that are required to do so that Israel is hoping for. But again, Israel and the U.S. believe that the momentum is positive.
And, Nick, what are you hearing from U.S. officials about the possibility of military action against Iran?
Yeah, those comments that we saw in the story just at the top that President Biden made this evening, that military action against Iran could be the last resort. U.S. officials insist that that is not a new message or a new change in policy at all. They cite examples from Secretary of State Antony Blinken talking about military action being the last resort. But clearly, Judy, the timing of those comments are vital. As President Biden arrives in the Middle East for the first time as president, regional actors here will certainly see those comments, and those comments will be reassuring to Israeli officials, despite, Judy, that ongoing disagreement over whether the U.S. and Iran should sign another nuclear deal.
Certainly, they caught our attention. Nick Schifrin reporting from Israel. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
There are now less than 4 months until the midterm elections in this country, and Democrats are facing a series of headwinds, from inflation to gun violence to abortion rights, that are affecting the attitude of Democratic voters. Meantime, as we've reported, a new New York Times Siena College poll out this week shows 60% of voters, including a quarter of Democrats, disapprove of the job President Biden's doing. Laura Barrón-López has more on that Democratic discontent.
Judy, despite the president's low approval ratings, that same poll shows the picture may not be as bleak for Democratic congressional candidates. Voters are evenly divided on which party should control Congress after the midterms. To discuss how Democrats are feeling about this election year, I'm joined by Celinda Lake. She is the president of Lake Research Partners, a Democratic polling group that regularly conducts focus groups with voters. She was also an advisor for President Biden's 2020 campaign. Celinda, thanks for joining us. Let's look beyond the numbers, because you're talking to Democrats and new voters in these focus groups. It's been 3 weeks since Roe was overturned. There's a new gun law. Why are President Biden's approval ratings stuck while Democrats are starting to see favorable movement?
Well, I think it's always slower. The presidential numbers are always slower to move, and the presidential numbers are very tied to the economy, and inflation is still a big problem. People don't expect their congressperson to solve the economy. They unrealistically do expect their president to solve the economy, including their own personal gas prices and the price for skirt steak and their grocery store. So I think that when you get to the congressional races, people are voting a lot more their local issues and what's happening in their states. They're voting things that are clear distinctions between the candidates. And there is no clearer distinction between the candidates right now than opinions on the overturning of Roe v. Wade and access to abortion and birth control for women.
You mentioned Roe, and I wanted to ask you, what are voters saying about what appears to some within his party, a cautious approach by President Biden in terms of executive actions to expand abortion access as well as shield patients?
Well, voters don't see it as cautious. Voters actually see the president as being very vocal, and the vice president has been very vocal as well. And when nothing's penetrating right now. There's so much noise out there. It's really hard to break through. But when you relay what the president and the vice president have been doing, what they've said they're going to try to do, that they want to do away with the filibuster to codify Roe, that they are applying every lever at their disposal, people are pretty impressed with that agenda. People are worried about what they can do and what can still be done with this really dramatic and out of the mainstream decision. And they want to ensure that people have access to abortion care, access to birth control, access to safe and legal and non-intrusive miscarriage care. And they're also worried about the slippery slope. They're worried about what happens now to marriage equality, what happens to interracial marriage, where are we going next?
On another issue of inflation, which is a big issue for Democrats heading into the midterms. Consumer prices are up 9.1% since last year, and that's driven by food prices up 12%. The cost of housing is up nearly 6%. Is this dragging down Democrats, and what do voters want them to do about it?
Well, voters want to hear from Democrats on it to begin with. Voters are very concerned when Democrats were saying this was going to be temporary inflation or transitional inflation. And voters would say things like, what planet are these economists living on? I'm not getting a transitory wage increase to deal with my transitory inflation. So the first thing is to recognize the problem, and you don't have a Democrat out there who's not articulate on this problem. And then using, again, all the tools at their disposal to deal with inflation, whether it's supply issues and baby formula, whether it's opening up petroleum reserves, whether it's going after price gouging on prescription drugs. They want action. But in the end, I think that we can only battle to even on the economy. And then I think the winning issues in this fall are going to be things like gun violence and voting rights and Roe v. Wade.
I want to cover two more quick topics with you, Celinda. The January 6 hearings have provided new evidence about former President Trump's efforts to pressure Justice Department officials, to even pressure his own vice president to overturn the 2020 election results. Are these revelations coming up in your focus groups with Democratic or independent voters?
They really are. They're coming up with Democrats a lot. First of all, 65% of voters are aware of the hearings and at least aware of some of the findings from the hearings. And among independent voters, it's actually slightly higher. It's 71%. That is unheard of. You never have independents paying more attention than Democrats and Republicans to what's going on. Voters think it's a crime. 82% of voters want accountability. Independents and Democrats really want accountability. And they're furious about the will of the people being overturned. And January 6th is just the beginning. That attack on our country was the beginning of overturning elections, overturning the will of the people, overturning people's votes. And now we have Roe overturning people's will there, with voters solidly opposing the decision. So this is a very big issue, and it's penetrated way more than anyone would have imagined.
Despite all of those issues that you just mentioned that could very well potentially motivate Democratic voters, recent polling shows that a majority of Democrats don't want President Biden to be the nominee in 2024. But are they naming any alternatives?
Oh, I think that those numbers are very flawed, honestly. It's a really silly question. In some ways, first of all, people are not naming alternatives. Secondly, Democrats give the president solidly positive job performance ratings, three quarters or better. Thirdly, voters almost say it as, you know, in the sense of it's a really hard job and maybe I'll offer him a retirement because it'll be easier on him, not that it'll be better for us. So those questions are extremely flawed. And I think what you'll see is Democrats uniting behind Democrats, Democrats uniting behind the president and supporting his agenda overwhelmingly.
Celinda Lake, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Laura. And we will be speaking with a Republican strategist about these and similar topics in coming days. A new coronavirus subvariant, BA5, is fueling yet another wave of COVID infections across the globe. This week, the CDC said BA5 is now the dominant strain in the U.S., accounting for more than 60% of cases. And as William Brangham explains, it is the most transmissible variant to date.
Judy, BA5 has proven to be a very wily variant, able to, at times, slip past some of our current defenses, the protections we get from vaccines and from previous infections. This is driving a lot of reinfections, even among people who recently had COVID. According to the CDC, almost 90% of the country lives in an area with high levels of transmission. On top of that, the U.S.'s booster campaign is lagging. Just 1 in 3 eligible people have gotten their first, and just 1 in 4 have their second. So what does BA5's dominance mean for our ongoing fight against this virus? For that, I am joined again by cardiologist Dr. Eric Topol. He's a professor of molecular medicine and founder and director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute. Dr. Topol, great to see you again. So BA5 is here. Some people have been arguing, well, it doesn't seem to be that deadly and doesn't seem to be driving that many people into the hospital. Is there some comfort to be taken in that? Is that true?
It is indeed true, William. The point is we have an immunity wall from all the prior vaccinations and infections and those combinations and boosters. So it isn't having the effect that we saw with the first Omicron, BA1. The problem with all the added mutations that the BA5 has on top of what was BA1 and 2 and 2.1.2.1, it has more mutations, which basically makes it an escape artist. That is, our immune system doesn't recognize it like we did the previous versions of the virus. And that's why some people who have had BA1 in January, February, are getting BA5 here in July. So this reinfection is a very significant signature of immune escape. It's the most reinfections we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic, because it's the most immune escape of any variant.
So how should we be approaching this? I know you have been in particular very critical of the way the CDC has been responding to this. What ought we be doing that we're not doing right now?
There's a lot we can do more. As was emphasized in the briefing yesterday by the White House team and CDC and NIH, we have to get the boosters way up from where they are. The high-risk people over age 50, only 1 in 4 in this country have had a 4-shot. And of all Americans, only 1 in 3 have had a booster at all, which is ranked 67th in the world, William, below countries like Sri Lanka and Rwanda, Iran. I mean, it's really embarrassing. I mean, we were the ones that manufactured, validated these vaccines in record time. And here we are not using this as our protection. And that's also the issues of the CDC about our isolation periods. If anything, where they say 5 days and you're good to go if you don't have symptoms, if anything, with BA5, it may well be extending. But the median infectiousness after COVID is 5 days. Not 5 days isolation, that's the median. So we are to send people out after 5 days. The CDC is really ignoring that. Still today, the CDC counts fully vaccinated as 2 doses. And for a year now, we've known the importance of boosters, even back to the Delta variant. And it's never been the principal message, a life-saving potential for people at risk, especially by the CDC.
Help me understand what we ought to think about this drug, Paxlovid. It didn't turn out to be a preventative, but it did show promise in stopping people who were infected from getting very, very sick. But there have been a lot of subsequent complications about it and slow rollout of the use of that. What do you make of that drug?
Well, it's certainly one of the triumphs of the pandemic, because it went from designing a new drug to having it validated with almost a 90% reduction of hospitalizations and deaths in less than 2 years. Usually that takes many years. And so it was very high velocity, validated. Now, the problem is what wasn't seen in the trials is being seen now is this frequent rebound where people take it for 5 days, they get much better, and then a couple of days later, it starts back up with another all the symptoms and infectiousness. So the rebound problem is likely tied to the fact that the Omicron variants weren't the ones that were tested when the trials were conducted. And so we don't know right now, should we use longer, 10 days instead of 5 days? So we've got to do better.
One last question, and I've traveled a fair amount around the country recently, and almost everywhere we go, despite the fact that we know that this virus is everywhere, people have moved on. Masks are increasingly uncommon, bars and restaurants are crowded, airplanes are crowded again. I mean, do you feel like the horse has sort of left the barn, and this idea that we need to, like this idea of people taking boosters or putting their masks back on, it just feels like the country is not there.
You're absolutely right. It's sad because we basically have capitulated to the virus, and our fatigue and our trying to will it away, it just doesn't work because the virus continues to evolve. We've never had an ability to contain it. So it's very likely things will get worse because of our unwillingness to try to keep up our guard. You either have to go aggressive, which we're not, or you surrender, which unfortunately, largely, we are.
All right, Dr. Eric Topol of Scripps Research, always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Long before the U.S. Supreme Court decided to overturn Roe v. Wade, Poland was rewriting rules on reproductive rights. Poland has some of Europe's strictest abortion laws, and further curbs in recent years have led to mass protests. But many in the historically Catholic nation are staunch supporters of government policy. Now, in what is a European first, one activist in Poland is facing jail time for helping another woman terminate an unwanted pregnancy. Special correspondent Rosie Burchard reports.
Poland, home to some 20 million women and girls, has the lowest official abortion rate in the European Union. For those who find themselves facing an unwanted pregnancy, there are few places to turn to find an official way out. From this Warsaw apartment, Justyna Wydrinska is a lifeline for Polish women looking for loopholes in their country's ban on most abortions. She tells them how to find pills online to self-administer or travel to clinics abroad, actions that fall within the grey zone of Poland's restrictions.
People who want to do abortions, they didn't disappear. They are here in this country, but they don't have a place to go and openly talk about their plans.
But in 2020, the activist broke the law and sent abortion pills directly to a woman who said she was trapped in an abusive relationship and feeling desperate, something Wydrinska herself once experienced.
I knew exactly what she was going through. I knew exactly how hard it was for her to fight for her like dignity, to fight for her right to stop this pregnancy. And this was my only motivation to really share my own pills with her.
The 47-year-old mother of three was reported to police and now faces up to 3 years behind bars for the criminal offence of aiding abortion. It wasn't always this way for women here in Warsaw. Under communist rule decades ago, abortion was broadly accessible. At the time, the Catholic Church was seen as an ally to the anti-communist resistance, fighting for democracy.
Church was the oasis of freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of expression of expressing own ideas and so on. So at the beginning of 90s, this experience of church, I think it was very quite alive, quite vivid among people.
As the Iron Curtain fell, the Church's view that life begins at conception gained political ground. Around 90% of Poles are Catholics. In 1993, abortion was declared illegal, except in cases of rape or incest, risks to the mother's health, or fetal defects. Then, in 2020, Poland's constitutional tribunal struck down the exception for fetal abnormalities, described by the country's anti-abortion rights movement as eugenic abortions. Chanting promises to protect their sisters if the government will not, thousands took to the streets to decry what they called a de facto total ban that could force women to carry to term babies that would never survive. Gynecologist Rafał Kuzlik says the shift has left some doctors like him struggling to find out just what's allowed and what's not.
We are afraid of doing anything what is called abortion because we don't know what will happen. Even if we see, okay, it is legally, should be legally, we are afraid if maybe someone tells us, no, it wasn't legal, you should check it, but we have no time. So we afraid to do it, so we do. We say, I'm sorry, I cannot do it for you.
The Polish government told us it issued guidance to make clear to doctors the circumstances under which they can facilitate terminations and urged practitioners to be unafraid to take action based on their medical knowledge. Lawmaker Bartłomiej Wróblewski says his country's rules reflect societal values.
Polish law is very similar to the laws of majority of democratic states 30 or 40 years ago, because we have still classic understanding of human rights. Right to life extends to the people who are not healthy, to disabled people, and we should not exclude from the right to life people who are weaker.
Wróblewski is part of the ruling Law and Justice Party, which, with its anti-abortion rights stance, has secured a majority in Poland's parliament. Another seismic shift began here in late February.
Millions of Ukrainians have arrived in train stations like this one, fleeing Russia's war across the border. Poland's efforts to offer homes to Ukrainian refugees have been internationally lauded. Welcome points like these ones are here waiting for the new arrivals, and they're offered quick access to the job market, education and healthcare. Among them are women seeking to end unwanted pregnancies.
This under-the-radar family planning information centre says it's received hundreds of inquiries from Ukrainian women, some of whom say they were raped by Russian soldiers. It's the latest flashpoint in a heated debate. Conservative activist Kaya Godek has been handing out flyers printed in Ukrainian to send a message to refugees.
Basically, it says that once you cross the border, you are safe from the war and your children are safe too. And if anyone presses you to have an abortion, you have to call the police.
Though rape victims are legally allowed abortions in Poland, Godek questions Ukrainians' claims.
Even if you have the law which allows you to kill a baby coming from a rape, how do you know it is a rape? Most of the women didn't come from eastern Ukraine. Most of them came from the western part of the country, and there is no war in the western part. So, you know, there are multiple questions about this kind of thing. I think that feminists were trying to use this situation to change the Polish law, saying that they help Ukrainians.
The Foundation for Women and Family Planning says its mission is to support women in need.
Polish law is too restrictive to allow to have an abortion for a Ukrainian woman without shame, without complications, without legal barriers. We discovered that Ukrainian women don't want to speak up about their war rapes. They just want to interrupt the unwanted pregnancy.
This national culture clash has also put Poland on a collision course with the European Union. Abortion is accessible in 25 out of the 27 EU countries, though gestational time limits vary. Only the tiny Mediterranean island nation of Malta has stricter laws than Poland. A majority of EU lawmakers voted to condemn Poland's abortion laws in 2021, and last week, the US was next on their list for public denunciation after the Supreme Court's decision last month to overturn Roe v. Wade.
In the most powerful country in the world, women have no right to decide over their own bodies. It's decided upon by men, old men at that, who are entrenched in a mindset of the past.
Back in Warsaw, Justyna's criminal case carries on at court, and though a conviction may loom, her convictions remain unchanged.
When there is restrictive abortion law, there is only more unsafe abortions. That's it.
For now, the phone keeps ringing, and Justina keeps picking up. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Rosie Burchard in Warsaw.
A new statue unveiled today at the U.S. Capitol marks a historic first. Civil rights pioneer Mary McLeod Bethune is the first Black American to represent a state in Statuary Hall. Congressional leaders celebrated the unveiling and Bethune's legacy.
How poetic that Dr. Bethune replaces a little-known Confederate general trading a traitor for a civil rights hero in the Capitol of the United States.
Dr. Bethune wasn't just a great Floridian. She was a great American. An American who refused to accept that her humble beginnings or the color of her skin were a limit on her dreams and on her destiny. And an American who, in the face of the ignorance, the cruelty, and the prejudice of others, she refused to surrender to bitterness or cynicism or despair.
Lisa Desjardins has more on the unveiling.
Each state has two statues representing them in the U.S. Capitol. Florida lawmakers voted to remove one of theirs, a statue representing a Confederate general, and replace it with a statue of Bethune. Joining me now is her granddaughter, Evelyn Bethune. And Evelyn, your grandmother is especially known for her pioneering and relentless work in education. That's why she is depicted in the U.S. Capitol as wearing a cap and gown. In fact, she created what would become Bethune-Cookman University, starting with just $1.50. It ultimately became a historically Black university. Tell us more about what she did.
Well, I think the key element is to know that in order for her to found the school, she had to be a great organizer and fundraiser. Bethune-Cookman University sits on what was the city garbage dump, which was the only land they would give her, let her purchase during that time period. Because, you know, women weren't really allowed, women, Black or white, were not allowed to vote, make decisions, buy property or anything unless a man gave them permission or assisted them. And so for her to acquire this property for $250 and work out a deal because she only had $1.50 was quite amazing for that time period. But my grandmother took those skills and she built relationships with people like the Roosevelts. And she made sure that she was able to organize communities and people to vote once the vote was given to women. She registered women to vote across this country. She founded the National Council of Negro Women, which is an organization that was made up of women in leadership in the organizations within their communities. And at one point, they had over 5 million women in their membership. That's a huge voting bloc. And with that carries a lot of power.
You know, we met earlier today at Statuary Hall ahead of the unveiling of this statue, and that's a very special place. It is also a place where there are still statues representing Confederates. And I just wonder what it was like for you, that moment when her statue was unveiled, looking in that place, what you think that meant for the Capitol and for our country.
For us as a family, it is a position of pride that's very humbling when we think of our grandmother, our descendant, being a part of Statuary Hall. The fact that there are Confederate soldiers there is, you know, very interesting to me since they lost the war. And, you know, it speaks volumes in terms of the thinking of the people who placed it there, how they still hold on to the tenets of, you know, enslavement and unequal access. My grandmother is a reminder of the good that comes when we share power, when we give access to everyone, and when we make voting accessible to everyone easily.
and not to make it so difficult that, you know, you can't get registered, you can't get to the polls. And that's not what this country is about. This country is about freedom.
It's interesting you talk about the power of representation in this country. And it was the Florida legislature that decided your grandmother was the one to represent the state, to change the image it presented at the Capitol. But we also know in recent months, the Florida legislature and governor have decided that they want to limit what teachers can actually say in classrooms about race and about our history of race. And I wonder what you think that means in general for society, but also for your grandmother's place in history.
Well, my grandmother's place in history is solid. There is very little that they can do to change her accomplishments unless we sit back and allow that to happen, which is not going to happen. It's a double-edged sword. On one hand, we want to have freedom of speech and freedom to carry weapons, but on the other, we don't want to give you the ability to talk about the history of enslavement, because if we don't talk about it, we will try to repeat it. And Americans who relish and cherish freedom have to stand up and vote and remove people from office who think that we should go back to Jim Crow in the 1920s.
Evelyn Bethune, thank you so much for sharing with us what you know about your grandmother.
You're welcome.
As the fighting in Ukraine continues, we take a musical journey to Odessa, Ukraine's historic port city on the Black Sea. It's a personal vision of a Ukrainian-born pianist, but also a deeper look at the city's past and present amid war. Jeffrey Brown has the story for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
It begins at the historic railroad station, entryway to the city, and you can hear the trains. Vadim Nesolovsky calls his new album Odessa, a musical walk through a legendary city. It was written to honor his father, who was dying of cancer, and his home city.
It's an effort to understand where I'm from. What are my roots? But it was just a starting point. I think it evolved into something bigger than that, because then my literal journey through my hometown becomes an imaginary journey into the history, into collective consciousness, into, you know, the darkest sides of Odessa's history.
Nesolovsky is a jazz pianist and composer who teaches at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, where we met recently. It's also the place he first studied in the U.S. He was born and raised in Odessa in a Jewish family during the Soviet era, and at 15 was the youngest ever student to attend the prestigious Odessa Conservatory of Music. Here he evokes his walks to school as snow fell. In Ukraine today, the sounds are very different. Nesolovsky composed his piece before the Russian invasion began on February 24th.
This was Odessa, Soviet port on the Black Sea.
But Odessa has known war before, and one turbulent section portrays the horrors of World War II, when Romanian troops under Nazi guidance brutalized the city and its inhabitants, including the murder of thousands of Jews. Nesolovsky, who regularly performs in Ukraine and maintains close ties to friends and fellow musicians there, his music had a new resonance.
February 24th changed my life, and I think it changed my life forever. It's just really before and after, for obvious reasons. And then I had to ask myself, is this music still relevant? And I realized, yes, it is, because there is enough drama in that story that I created. My drama was based on the Second World War memories of Odessa. And now we have very often same images that we saw from the Second World War, but now we see them in a color photography and videography.
So when you're playing them now, you're feeling and seeing something different than you did when you first wrote them.
Absolutely. Thank God I'm a jazz musician. I get to improvise. And I cannot play without imagining those things myself. If I don't feel those things, you won't be feeling them.
Nesselovsky is a rare mix of classically trained pianist and brilliant jazz improviser, a musical omnivore for whom different sounds have always flowed together.
It was always one thing. It was this ocean of creativity in sound, and it could come from Keith Jarrett, it could come from Johann Sebastian Bach, it could come from Paul McCartney or Joni Mitchell.
I mean, I hear all of them in your music, right? You want me to hear them?
I want you to hear them, yes.
The final section of this ode to Odessa speaks to the flowering that had been taking place in recent years within an independent and democratic Ukraine. Now it too holds new meaning.
And I saw it as a sign of renaissance, as a sign of hope for my city. But of course, after February 24th, after this horrible war has started, I also play this music as a prayer for peace and for my home country, for Ukraine.
From benefit concerts and sales of his new album, Odessa, a musical walk through a legendary city, Vadim Nesselovsky has to date raised some $200,000 for humanitarian relief efforts in Ukraine. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the Berklee College of Music in Boston.
Inspiration, as that country needs it. Meantime, in Louisiana, there are thousands of orphaned oil and gas wells that pose a threat to residents and to the environment. New federal funding will help the state plug many of these abandoned wells. But some question if that's enough. You can learn more on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.